accession number 28898, reel 7.
Matt Charlesworth, reel 7.
So, I went across this awful discomfort of this sweaty, not being able to take your clothes off, and this grungy, still itching, because it didn't do any good this for the rest of the trip. Well, you had that to do. Then you're going to the rough seas, you're crashing about in the cabin from one side to the other. The rations were abysmal. In fact, old Joe Lamp, one of the pilots I went with, and myself, we used to wait till it was midnight watch, when there was very few people on watch. And we'd sneak down to the canteen and we'd get ourselves a couple of eggs and some bacon, and we'd fry them up and have some egg and bacon, which no one knew what to put away. But it was just discomfortable, banging and crashing, and of course always under attack, or being right there, U-boats ahead. We'd be told a pack of U-boats ahead, so I'd be sound to. And I remember the first year, the skipper came in and he said to us, of course they're all sea dogs, they've been at sea for years, these old captains of merchant ships. He said, "You've got any guns with you?" I said, "No." "Oh, we had to join these ships as able seamen. We weren't allowed to be, in case we were captured, because we weren't allowed to be, no one knew about it, so we were."
Was it still carrying a merchant cargo as well?
Oh, yes. Carrying goods, mainly high explosives on the way back. So when you see one hit by a torpedo, it's a sight to behold. It's like a nuclear explosion. A merchant ship full of explosives going up, it's a frightening experience.
You said the captain said, "Have you got any guns?"
Yes, I said, "No, we haven't got a gun." He said, "Right, so I'm going to give each a 38 revolver. He said, "I've got some Lascar seamen." They were sort of half Indian and half, I don't know what they were, but they were coloured fellows. I said, most of the seamen, the stokers and all that sort, they're all Lascar seamen. And he said, what they tend to do, he said, if a ship's attacked, they will rush to, I think we had two lifeboats. They rush to these lifeboats, and two will get onto one lifeboat, slash the things, drop it in the water, tow them aboard, with rations for 20 men or whatever it is, whichever lifeboat could hold, probably 20 men, I don't know. And so they push off and they've got all these rations. So he said, "You have my authority, and believe you me, I've got the authority as well, that you just shoot any Alaska seaman who tries to get into one of those boats on his own and get it free. Just shoot him through the head, kill him. Get him out of the way. Well, I'm not losing all my men through one Alaska seaman." I thought, Christ, the thought of shooting somebody in cold blood, that's a bit dicey. But anyway, fortunately, we didn't have to do that, but that was a routine if they did get into these boats.
Can you remember what this first ship was that you went across the Atlantic in?
I can only remember the name of one. I think it was a Dagestan. I don't know. It had some sister ships, all ending in Stan, but this, I think it was a Dagestan.
There was only a limited number, weren't there, of the catapult-assisted merchant?
Oh, yes. Very few. A small community of pilots that speak, some at Halifax in Nova Scotia, some down in Gibraltar, and a little pool in Murmansk, which was a dicey one, in Russia. And but it was a sheer, and you know, we did a trip down to Gibraltar, and on the way down, the captain said, "I've got some orders here." He said, I've got to open them in the presence of you, latitude so and so, and we got that latitude. He called us into his cabin. And he opened these sealed orders, and it said, "The invasion of North Africa is on the way. You are not to go into Gibraltar. You are to make for the port of Algiers and unload your cargo there." We were full of high explosives and amatol, and just crammed full of shells and things. And so I thought, "Oh, that's interesting." And he said, "And meantime, also, as you go through the Straits of Gibraltar, the Merchant Service Fighter Unit pilots have to stand down. They're not to fly because there'll be lots of British aircraft, lots of enemy aircraft, and we don't want a lot of Hurricanes flying around that no one knows anything about. So they're to stand down and make your way to Algiers and load there." So we were, good God, we were in North Africa, you know. It's a little interesting. So, my God, we got us through the Straits of Gibraltar along the North African coast. All mayhem. Well, some went into Gibraltar, about a third of the convoy had to go through. Less than that, actually. About a quarter. And designated ships, you know, destroyers came alongside and said, you're designated to go through. We said, yes, we've got the soldiers here. And so we went through. And we were attacked the whole time. Torpedo bombers, dive bombers, Savoy Marchetti, low-level bombers. And we just got, fortunately, we hadn't been hit. We'd lost a couple of ships going up towards Algiers. And we were all the ammunition ships, because we wanted ammunition for the First Army that was going forward. And to see it, just be on deck and see a torpedo, hit a merchant ship full of ammunition, just as sort of alongside you virtually, or what length, what distance apart it would be, probably 100 yards perhaps, bother the garden there, get a direct hit from a torpedo. It was like the noise, the cloud, a great mushroom of sound and smoke, then pashing on the deck of all the bits and pieces that fell out of this. It was terrifying. And anyway, we got alongside Algiers, and a destroyer came alongside with a loud hailer to four of us and said, we're just capturing Bone Harbour. First Army was just capturing Bone. You were to proceed to Bone and unload at Bone Harbour. We thought, oh, God, another bloody 36 hours of up this coastline. And that was, we lost two of the four through Bombay. And to see a torpedo coming towards you and then just missing your stern and seeing what the effect it has when it hits, actually hits something. It was a sweaty old business, believe you me.
Did you see a torpedo doing that
thing? Well, yes, we did. That's why I'm mentioning it. I was standing on the deck, and Savoy and Marchetti, there's a battalion aircraft, they were coming through the convoy, doing low-level torpedo dropping. And I said, there's a bloody Savoy and Marchetti coming towards us there. And I said, Christ, yes. And it dropped its torpedo, aiming for us, actually. And you can see the wake. See the wake coming towards you. And I thought, that's going to hit us. We're going to go up. We're going to go up. And it went by the stern by yards. It missed the stern by many yards. Oh, Christ, that. But this dive bombing, eventually we were hit, just before we got to Bone Harbour, we were hit in the stern by a Stuka dive bomber, which put the rudder out of action. And so he grounded this thing on. He couldn't steer it, so he grounded it on the sand there. And we were just under attack then. I said, look, we're not doing any good here. Can we get ashore? And he said, well, okay. He said, you can have. We had a small pinnace as well as the two boats. He said, you can take all your RAF crew. We had four airmen. One to look after the guns, one to look after the fuselage, engineer, electrician, and two pilots, and one naval officer who directed us from the bridge of the ship. So they would steer right. His job was to direct you towards the Condor by radio. So I said, look, can we go? He said, yeah, you can take that, lower it and get ashore. So we went ashore. And we got ashore and went into Bone, and it was being fought over. Bone was actually being fought over at the time, and the shells were whistling about, and there were booms and crashes and things. We thought, Christ, where's the funny British army? Over there, right? And eventually we came to a little, it must have been a cafe or a hotel, it was in its heyday, and we went in there. And because we hadn't eaten anything or drunk anything for a long time, we were bloody hungry and thirsty. And the woman who owned it, an Italian woman who was absolutely out of her mind. Oh, what to do, oh dear. And all the staff had left apart from her very pretty receptionist. And I said, look, have you got something to eat? Can I have something to eat? So she said, eat. We didn't speak Italian. She spoke Italian. Anyway, she said, oh, I have these eggs. And so she made us a 22 egg, all the eggs she had, omelette. Never seen anything like it. And a couple of crates of champagne. You could have these. So where can we sit? And at the backyard, we saw two army officers around a table, looking all dirty and bedraggled, and they were having tucking into something. So it was any table. Said, can we join you? And they said, yeah, come sit down. Where have you come from? Be in an RAF uniform. Where have you come from? Green, the brass of your hat's all green, salt water. I said, well, ship was just down there. Oh, well, they're a bit drunk anyway. So we said, join them. We all drank champagne and ate, chatted away. Suddenly I thought, this major commando on my left, there's commander in on here, and major to major, because I had a badge of rank, about 3 days growth of stubble. And I recognised his voice or something about him. And I thought, I was going to ask the question. I said, excuse me, you're not Randolph Churchill by any chance, are you? He said, yes, I am. He's son of Winston Churchill. And he'd been dropped behind the lines, and he was making his way back. And opposite him was a chap called G. Ward Price, who was the chief war correspondent for the Daily Telegraph. Now, to hear Randolph, as he got more and more champagne aboard, talking about his father, was the most interesting conversation I've had in my life. First-hand knowledge of his father, all the intimate details. And G. Ward Price was a very great expert on war. And anyway, we had a bit of a hilarious set together. And then, of course, after that, we thought, well, what are we going to do now? Here we are, two loose pilots wandering about in the midst of two people fighting each other, right in the centre of the battle. Where we go? So we saw a British jeep, eventually, going back westwards towards where we'd come from, where the army was coming from. And we flagged him down, and they first of all said they thought we were German, they were going to shoot us, because we had the same field grey uniform on, see, almost like their field grey uniform. And they said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, no matter about that, are you going back towards the west? So they said, yes, pop aboard. So we hopped aboard, and then we got back towards Tripoli, and we thought, well, we've got to do something. We've got to contact somebody, you know. We can't just wander about North Africa like two loose ears. So we went out and said, are there any hurricane squadrons around here? And they said, yes, there's a 32 squadron out over there. And I went across, and it was out in the desert. And I went into this tent, which said commanding officer on it. And there was a young Australian chap called Shaw, I remember him. He said, what the hell are you doing? Where do you come from? So we can't tell you about that, but we're here. We're both hurricane pilots. Can we be of any assistance to you? He said, well, have you got any identity? No, we can't, not allowed to carry identity. He said, well, what's your case? We'll tell you about this around. He said, well, why should I think you can fly hurricanes? I said, well, because we can. He said, all right, there's a hurricane, fly it. They had one standing there, so they had four cannon hurricanes. So he's got into it. I flew around it a couple of times, landed. He said, Joe Lamb. He said, okay, you've got to have a go. Landed. He said, okay, you better join the squadron then. He had no pay. He said, come and borrow some money. We haven't got any money. He said, what do you want to spend it on? We can't spend it on anything. But it was just a farcical time we had there. And until eventually we got into Tripoli itself and found the town marshal and said, look, we've got to do something about getting back to our outfit. He said, well, who are you? Where are you from? He said, well, we told him. We said that we're from a city called MSFU, and the ship's been bombed, and we've got to get back to Gibraltar. Gibraltar was the nearest subunit. So eventually a transport aircraft of some sort was going back to Gibraltar, and we got aboard and went back there. And that's where I was, I'm afraid, because of all the mayhem and bedlam and bombing and shooting and strafing and all the rest and lack of food and discomfort of having been at sea for a long time and then wandering about North Africa, got to Gibraltar, and the lad said, in the unit there, said, well, where the hell are you sprung from? He's looking all scrubby. Said, well, this is what we told them, of course. There were about five pilots in the unit there, waiting to go one way or the other. And they said, well, let's go to Gibraltar and have a few beers. So we went into Gibraltar. Of course, we never drank at sea at all. We never drank anything. So if I want to do this, I want to be dead cold sober. so we didn't drink anything at sea at all. And we'd been a long time without any drink. I do like a pint of beer. So they said, we went to a nightclub there in Gibraltar, and it was up a flight of stairs into a very dark room, about twice the size of this, with a little stage at the end, with girls dancing about half naked, doing da 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 da, you know. And drinking beer, and I went, well, they're pretty girls, I haven't seen a girl for a donkey's years. And so I thought, I kept sort of looking in my direction, I kept looking in her direction. And eventually I thought, I'm going to have her. So I put my beer down, I ran down, got onto the stage and picked her up. Carried her behind. And I was immediately set upon her by Spanish, you see, used to come in from Spanish La Línea or some local town, work in the dockyards, and then go back at night. And they were very anti-British and pro-German, Spanish at the time. They were a fascist country, and but they earned good money, so they did it. And in this place, they used to have a drink in this place before going home. So there was a Spanish that leapt at me, and a great fight started. And eventually, the fight rolled down these stairs onto a pavement that was bright sunshine. People were going by with tennis rackets and what the hell's going on here? And the police came along, Spanish. They were Spanish, British somehow. I don't know quite what they were doing. Anyway, because I can't remember it very well, they picked me up and they said, "We can't have this." Of course, I was in an officer's uniform. And they said, "Right, fighting, brawling in the street, got to go get going to jail." They took me to jail. Well, on the way to jail, I managed to get one hand free, and I thumped the chap in the face. They got them really riled. They got my hands behind my back, and they feet off the ground, frog marched into the jail, threw me into a cell, and the cell was full of prostitutes and no goodness. And I thought, of course, I was still full of the grog. And slowly, as the night wore on, I got more and more sober. And I thought, what the hell am I doing here? Gee, well, I've got to get out of this. So I rattled the railings. I said, "What do you want?" I said, "I want to get in contact with main base, North Camp in Gibraltar, and get the police to come and get me out, get somebody to come and get me out of here." So they got in touch with them, and then eventually the military police came down. Well, they weren't military police because they had no tactical officers, except somebody came down, a duty officer or somebody. And he's gone and said, "What the hell are you doing here? What are you doing?" I said, "I'll have to leave that later on. But headache, cut over the eye and all the rest of it." And went back and went to bed. The next morning, two severe-looking officers called in and said, "The station commander wants to see you immediately." So I said, "Oh, all right. So anyway, I went across to the station commander, and he was sitting behind his desk, and he said, I stopped attention in front of him, feeling a bit wobbly at the knees, and he said, "Your name's Charlesworth, isn't it?" I said, "Oh, yes, that's right." He said, "Right." He said, "I said to the last merchant service fight unit idiot who came through here, that if any more bad behaviour from your unit, and I would court-martial the next one that was involved in it, and it's you, so you're going to be have a summary of evidence taken against you, and if it warrants it, you'll be court-martialed." And I was. I was court-martialed on two charges. One was Section 1 of the Air Force Act, which says anybody unbecoming charged with and found guilty of acting in a manner unbecoming an officer and gentleman will be cashiered. And if you're cashiered, your commission's taken away. In the wartime, you're re-enlisted as an airman, the lowest possible rank, ACH, where you serve in kitchens and scrub kitchen floors, and you know, you finish a flyer. Another one was acting in a manner unbecoming an officer, prejudicial to good order and discipline, different section. I said, "Right, so we'll take a summary of evidence and we'll see how it goes." The summary of evidence really is to see whether there's sufficient evidence to make the charge stick. A bit like a pre-magistrate's hearing in Sioux Street. Well, of course, all the people that I'd been with, they'd all disappeared. They found some Spanish people there, who acted as my opposition, said, oh, yeah, they saw this drunken idiot fighting in the street. All the Spanish people had gone home anyway that I was with. I had an opera with me, and he disappeared. So I think he'd flown off back to Africa by the time the court martial came up. And so I had nobody who could say, well, this is what happened. In any case, it wouldn't sound very good picking up a naked woman and taking her. So they said, right, I went to the court martial. And they said, right, we've got sufficient grounds for court martial here. So I've been court martialed. And I thought, well, I'm 19. What am I going to tell my parents? They've given me a good education. All this stuff. Here I am. We've got to be court martialed and take that. What a disgrace. Oh, God. Anyway, court martialed me. And then I had to go out and wait for the sentence, board of five officers. To go outside and wait for the sentence. You have an officer's prisoner's friend, who's another officer with me, and he said, "Oh, it's not looking very good, Max, but I think it'll be all right." I said, "Well, well, that'll be all right. He's already waiting for them to make up their minds. You see, you're in another room outside whilst they're deliberating." And I thought, "Oh God, this is the end of all my dreams and hopes." But I was so worried about what my parents would think of me. And then eventually they said, "Right, they've reached the verdict." I thought, oh, here we go, march back in, stand there, Charles, Sam's attention in the dock. And fortunately, they dismissed the charge of acting in a manner and becoming an officer and a gentleman, which was automatic cut hearing. They found me guilty of the second one, which I sighed with relief because I knew I wouldn't be discharged. And they gave me a year's seniority and a severe reprimand. My documents, and I thought, oh, thank God for that, and it was just a relief. And then we came back on a camship back to England with the convoy, and when I got back, oh, I'll tell you about that too. Oh, we had to stand too in the whole convoy had to heave too in the Bay of Biscay on the way back because a hurricane or something came through. The sea was white. The propeller kept coming out of the water and thrashing in the air, and the boat was rolling. I think, Christ, we're going over. No, we're not. We're going over. I'm bashing about inside. We couldn't eat for 2 days in this hurricane, this terrible weather. And the hurricane was taking great seas over it. And when the weather subsided, two smaller ships had foundered and they'd gone down. Anyway, we started off again then, started trekking back towards Liverpool, and had a dozy first lieutenant, ship's first lieutenant, deputy to the captain, I don't know what they call him now. Anyway, he was a navigating officer for this trip. But we didn't see the sun from leaving Gibraltar to getting back. I said, well, where are we now? And he'd say, well, we've been steering from 020 or something for the last 24 hours, so right up, we're there, big cross. The cross covered about 100 miles. So this went on for several days until we came through the Straits of Northern Ireland and Scotland, what they call the Irish Straits, I think they call it, or something. And then I got a signal from... Oh, the captain came and said, we've got a signal. He said, you've got to launch... at point 30 miles north of the Isle of Anglesey. So I said, well, I don't know whether I've checked whether this hurricane is serviceable, first of all. And it was in a terrible mess. Anyway, I had four airmen, and they got it going, got the engine going. I was checking it out with them, and it seemed to be okay. But I was worried about where we were, because I had no radio contact with anybody, and I couldn't radio and say, give me a steer to base. So I thought, well, where are we? So I went into the second officer and said, look, can you tell me where we are? I've got a launch just 23 miles north of Anglesey. He said, okay, I'll tell you. He said, right, we're there now. I said, well, where are we? He said, well, we're there. And all he'd gone by was how they'd been steering for the previous day. Well, of course, you've got magnetic variation, you've got the ship's variation. And as I said, each cross covered Lord knows how many miles. So I thought, well, do you think Anglesey really is north south of us, about 30 miles? He said, yeah. I said, okay. So I said, I'm going to launch, Captain. I saw you see the captain. He said, you're not going to take that thing off, are you? I said, yeah, I've got to do it. He said, we'd like a spot of brandy. I said, no, thanks. I wanted to be sober. So anyway, I climbed aboard this thing. And I looked at it, I thought, well, I hope it's all right, but it's not looking very good. Anyway, we got the engine started. And because all the rockets had been taking water in and everything, it was all very Heath Robinson. It was reasonably calm water. And I was dreading it. Anyway, it fired me off. And fortunately, I came to it, and it was flying. I thought, well, at least we're flying. Although the engine had the usual glycol leaks, which if that goes on, if you lose all the glycol, the engine ceases. So I turned around the ship and I saw more waving. And in fact, they were waving because the sea had knocked the Hurricane slightly sideways on the trolley. And when I launched, I ripped a great big hole down the side of the back of the Hurricane. It was fabric over metal. And all the fabric from under the elevators was flapping. They could see this. That was damaged. I couldn't see it. And so they were saying, you know, go up, go away. Well, I think I set fire to the captain's cabin too, because he forgot to close all his concrete shutters. I started flying south. I thought, well, I'll just hope for the best. So I flew at the most economical speed, and I was worried about the engine ceasing because I was losing life all the time. And the time that it should have taken me to get there went by, and I had no sign of land. It was a day of about 1,000-foot cloud base and solid cloud. So you couldn't see anything at all, and not a lot of visibility, 2 miles of visibility perhaps. And so I just kept droning along with this grey sea and grey sky, out of contact, radio contact with everybody. Time went by, no land. So I thought it'd be all, perhaps 40 miles north, could be all time. No land, engine spluttering, no land. Oh, it's a bit icy land, no land. So I thought, well, God damn it, there must be land somewhere to my east, to the west of me. East of me, rather. There's got to be somewhere, Norway, it might be Norway, it might be Spain, I don't know. But there's got to be land that way, so I'm going to just turn in, crash land aircraft if I have to. So I turned in, I turned left, started flying due west, due east. Still no land. I thought, actually, where's this? I'm going to have to ditch the aircraft and bail out. No one knows where I am. And also, when we used to come back out from the Gibraltar trips, we used to put behind the cockpit and everywhere we could, we used to put bottles of sherry and cheap watches, which we used to buy cheaply in Gibraltar. I don't know whether this should be published, really. Cheaply in Gibraltar, then given to the fellows when we got back. And there's stuff in all the odd corners of the aircraft. So anyway, flying eastwards, and suddenly I saw a range of sort of what looked like mountains all around. I thought, what the hell? Mountains? It can't be Blackpool area. Because Anglesey, as you know, is just on the tip of... And it suddenly occurred to me that it could be the bay, or what's that bay called, the big bay, that Aberystwyth in the centre of it anyway. And I was struggling with maps, and eventually I sorted myself out. I thought, yes, is this bay? I just got to turn north, and I'll get to Anglesey. So I turned north and tried to select the undercarriage down, and it wouldn't go down, it just stayed up. So there's an emergency pump that you can pump on a Hurricane. And it's a very difficult pump, not that I'll spit fire on this, so I pumped away like that. And eventually I got two greens. I got the undercarriage down. I did a circuit and I landed at Anglesey. And as I got out of the aircraft, I looked back at it. I saw all the canvas flapping off it. I thought, gee whiz, did I actually fly? And I thought, well, I can't stop here. I've got to just refuel and check in. You had to check in there always, coming back from there. Always checked in Anglesey. So I went to the air traffic control and said, oh, I'm just checking in. Where have you flown from, sir? Well, Gibraltar. I said, you can't fly from Gibraltar. I said, well, I didn't know whether these people knew about it or not. Anyway, I thought, I've got... So the engineer officer came in and said, where's the pilot of this aircraft that's just landed? I said, there he is, it pointed to me. He said, well, I was bearded and everything. He said, what are you... You're not allowed to grow beards in the pilot. Anyway, and he said, well, that aircraft is grounded. It is 100% unserviceable. It's not going to, you can't fly into the yard. And I thought, well, I've got to fly it back to Speke, which is just down the coast from there. So he got inside